Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Zoé Hocker est soudeur. Il se perfectionne dans le métaverse avec la plateforme de formation virtuelle de ForgeFX. Selon lui, la soudure virtuelle permet de s'entraîner autant qu'on le souhaite, d'améliorer ses compétences et de saisir des opportunités. Grâce à la Tulsa Welding School, Zoé et d'autres soudeurs peuvent utiliser la plateforme de ForgeFX pour renforcer leur expertise et répondre à la demande de travailleurs qualifiés dans le contexte économique actuel. Voilà comment des professionnels qualifiés utilisent le métaverse aujourd'hui.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Rachel Wright, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 1st of October, these are our main stories. The vast majority of ethnic Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh have fled across the border. A last-minute stopgap measure to avoid another US government shutdown, and pies and humans begin their annual turf war in Australia. Also in this podcast, what the election result in the Maldives means for China and India, and the unusually super-friendly animal barred from a US baseball stadium.
He is my emotional support alligator. And I wake up, he'd be laying on my head.
Makes me feel loved.
The pictures show an endless stream of cars full of people and their possessions. Armenian officials say over 100,000 Armenian residents have left Nagorno-Karabakh, an enclave surrounded almost entirely by Azerbaijan, except for the one road out. Many are still stuck in the endless traffic jam on that one road through the mountains. Journalist Siranish Sarkisyan is one of those waiting to cross the border into Armenia.
This exodus is unbearable, not only psychologically, as many people here are becoming refugee already third time in their life. But this exodus, it's also unbearable physically, because we already 60 hours spent in this road. It seems like we can reach border.
But once that border is reached, crossing it can be a daunting prospect. Gev Iskashian and his family were among the lucky ones to have completed the journey from Nagorno-Karabakh's largest city to the Armenian capital, Yerevan.
Approaching that border, there's a real sense of fear. There have been multiple arrests there. That fear of persecution is always there. We're actually very thankful for the fact that as soon as we got to the other side, there was a score of volunteers, many of them youth, that were there to greet the people of Nagorno-Karabakh with food, water, supplies, even fuel.
Our correspondent Rayhan Dimitri has just arrived in the southern Armenian town of Goris and described the scene there.
Well, I'm outside one of the reception points where people have been registering for nearly a week now. There's less people now compared to what we've seen at the beginning of this exodus. But still, dozens of people kind of wandering around. There are lots of minibuses and people are still registering there. And then they're being allocated to go to a certain minivan and be taken to different parts in Armenia. I was talking to one man. His name is Vitali Safarian. He wanted to tell me his story, and he said that a week ago he was on the front line. He's a contractor and a military man. And he said that he was actually surrounded by a lot of Azerbaijanis, but there was no violence or insults, and there were Russian peacekeepers that helped him to get out of that situation. He said there were about 100 of them and just me alone. And he said, yes, that it was really scary, but nothing happened. And he said, you know, the clothes that I'm wearing, someone just gave it to me. I've got nothing. I didn't even have time to go and get my passport. So I think there's still a lot of this uncertainty for people. They're still in a state of shock, I would say.
And do we know what's going to happen to these refugees? Are they going to camps or are they going to stay with relatives?
So at the moment, some are going to temporary accommodation that was set up by the Armenian government. A vast majority are going to stay with their relatives, but it's all kind of temporary measures. And at this stage, since we're so close to this crisis, it just happened, you know, within the last few days, the long-term solution is really not clear. But we know that aid is coming to Armenia. We know that the UK government pledged £1 million today. And on top of that, more aid from the Western countries to help Armenia deal with this crisis.
Rehan Dimitri in the Armenian town of Goris. The US House of Representatives may have just bought themselves more time to prevent a government shutdown. A temporary bill has been passed to keep the government running for a further 45 days. It's a last-ditch measure that is now in the hands of the Senate before they can avoid disruption to hundreds of thousands of bin collectors, air traffic controllers and the military. The Republican Speaker, Kevin McCarthy, is the architect of the bill and has been under intense pressure from members of Congress from his own side.
Winston Churchill once said this about America: you can always count on Americans to do what's right after they exhausted every other option. It is very clear that I tried every possible way, listening to every single person in the conference. When we went to vote on appropriate bills you didn't think we could pass, we passed them. Would I have wanted the bill we put on the floor yesterday that would secure our border, cut wasteful spending? Yes, I did. But I had some members in our own conference that wouldn't vote for that.
But the plan does not include money for the war in Ukraine, a source of contention for Democrats. Shortly before recording this podcast, I got an update from Sean Dilley, our North America correspondent in Washington.
Oh, my goodness. It's difficult to even follow it. My head is spinning. It didn't look like a deal was going to be possible at lunchtime. It looked like there was so much division sown that Democratic and Republican members of the House of Representatives were not going to reach a deal. It was a slight surprise they did, because they tried to pass their own separate deal yesterday that cut much deeper, about 30%, for example, off of Social Security funding. And they wanted to introduce very strong border controls that simply wouldn't have been acceptable to Democratic senators. Hardliners, around nine of them in the Republican Party, had made it clear that if Kevin McCarthy, their own speaker, attempted to lean on Democratic support to get through a deal that the upper chamber, the Senate, had already agreed, that would be something that would force them to remove Kevin McCarthy from office. Now, I don't know if you've seen the Netflix House of Cards, the British one or the American one. This is right out of one of those plot lines. At the moment, I mean, you can never quite tell, but it looks like the Senate will rubber stamp this. It will look like the 45 days of funding continues, but then it begins an almighty argument about funding for Ukraine and the message that sends to Kyiv. And then, even leaving that to one side, it's sort of kicking it down the road again. We might see all this again come Thanksgiving.
Sean Dilley in Washington. Today, Robert Fico stood to become the Slovak Prime Minister for the third time, and his left-wing populist Smer party was leading in the polls in advance of the general election. But he faced a strong challenge from the Progressive Party. Ukraine was one of the issues of contention, with Mr. Fico saying he would end military aid to Ukraine, while his opponent publicly supports Kyiv. The first exit polls were released shortly before we started recording this podcast. Our correspondent, Rob Cameron, who's in the region, told me more.
That original exit poll really produced a shock result Progressive Slovakia, the liberal pro-Western party, which had begun nipping at the heels of Robert Fico and his populist Smer party in recent weeks and days, it appears that they have won the election. It was just an exit poll, but another exit poll has now been released confirming this. We have two exit polls suggesting that Progressive Slovakia, and not Robert Fico's Smer party, has won this election. But it's going to be a long night ahead. Ballots had obviously just been counted now, and we're just getting the first results in. But certainly a surprise, and one I think that will be welcomed in some quarters in the West, in NATO and in the EU.
Indeed, what were the main issues for voters in this election?
Well, Ukraine obviously was one of them. It wasn't the only issue, but of course it was, and that was because it was brought to the fore by Mr. Fico thundering that he wouldn't send a single round of ammunition to Ukraine if he were elected. But there were lots of other issues too: the cost of living crisis, pensions and the state of the health service, and the poor quality of university education. 17% of Slovak high school graduates leave the country every year and study abroad, and half of them never come come back. And that produces a real brain drain for this country of 5.5 million people. And that's one of the things that this Liberal Party, Progressive Slovakia, wants to stop, to woo those people to come back, saying that there is a future for young Slovaks who believe in their country's membership of the EU and NATO and want an inclusive, liberal, tolerant, progressive society. They seem to have won the upper hand in this election. But, of course, the real hard work of coalition building, creating a new government, that's just beginning.
Rob Cameron. The cost of Storm Daniel, which devastated the centre of Greece in early September, is continuing to be counted. The resulting floods killed more than 200,000 animals and destroyed around a fifth of the country's cotton crop, as well as damaging the season's corn and fruit trees. It's believed the short-term effects alone could cost the Greek economy up to $5 billion. One of the worst-hit areas is the Thessaly Plain, one of the country's main agricultural regions, raising fears about the impact on food production. Bethany Bell reports from Karditsa region in Thessaly.
This is my house. All water, all.
And Thula shows me around the wreck of her home. The house, like many others in this village of Lochos, was almost totally submerged in water.
Here is my bedroom here.
Oh, my goodness. Mud thick on the ground. Smells horrible. Mm. On the roof of the house next door, you can see the rotting carcass of a dead sheep. It must have been swept there by the floodwaters. And Thula's daughter Maria says they've been abandoned by the authorities.
Nothing from the government, nothing from the mayor, nothing at all. It's terrible. This is Greece, not the island, not the blue sea, not the blue sky. This is Greece.
Greece's Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis promising speedy aid for the victims of the flooding. But many people here say it's simply not enough. In the village of Lefki, Thanasis Thodos shows me what's left of his walnut tree orchard. He had about 1,000 trees here, and he's lost half of them. The ground is scattered with dead and decaying trees, brown leaves, dusty and dead.
The question is how much the state will be able to help us with the compensation, because our equipment has also been damaged. All I can think about is my toil, my sweat and my suffering for the last 10 years. That's all I can see right now. I try to do something good, but my dreams have been shattered.
The rector of Greece's agricultural university, Spiros Kintsios, says that while it is possible to replant crops like cereals and cotton within the next few months, restoring orchards and herds of sheep and goats will take longer. He says supporting local communities is crucial.
We have now damages in housing infrastructure and also municipality services, roads, schools, primary health units and so on. If we don't manage to restore them as soon as possible, then we'll have the problem that the people will have to go somewhere else, to big cities to live. If the population, the local population, cannot stay there, then we cannot relaunch the agricultural production.
In the village of Koskinas, Themis Apostolakis and his father Apostolis try to kick-start their tractor. They say they've lost this year's cotton and corn crops. Themis says the future looks grim.
Our lives have changed dramatically, and the only thing that we could save is ourselves.
Do you think you have a future building again with agriculture here?
No. The water is now polluted by the oil. I don't know what we can rebuild again. I don't know.
Bethany Bell with that report. Don't run and think about donning a hard hat. This is some of the sobering advice given to Aussies each spring to protect themselves from swooping Australian magpies. The birds are known to attack humans on the ground as they protect their nests during breeding season, which is August to October. This is the sound of one unfortunate boy being repeatedly pecked and harangued by a swooping magpie while riding his scooter in New South Wales. His dad was recording.
Hey!
Ornithologists insist not all Australian magpies attack humans, and they are, in fact, a clever species. The BBC's Tiffany Turnbull is in Sydney and spoke to Valerie Sanderson about some people's experiences with magpies in Australia.
Just last week, a cyclist was in the news after he came out and told his story, and he was left partially blinded by a magpie attack. He says that the magpie flew down out of nowhere, pecked him in the eye, did a backflip, and then pecked him in the eye again. And so he was left needing major surgery to insert a prosthetic eye lens. But it's not just him. We do tend to see cases like this every year or two. And people have actually also been known to have died while trying to escape magpie attacks. There have been 3 deaths in about the last decade, including a really shocking case in 2021 where a mother who was trying to run away from the birds fell and her daughter died, her newborn daughter. They say that magpies only attack when provoked. And it's important to note that only a few of the male magpies do swoop, and only ever during breeding season when they're protecting their nests. Some estimates say as little as about 10% of magpies swoop, and they only ever do it if provoked. But the problem is that really simple things like running through their territory or riding a bike through their territory can trigger them to swoop.
And what actions are being taken to try to avoid people being hurt and indeed magpies attacking?
Authorities each year are now putting up signs wherever they see a nest warning people. It's advice like don't run, carry an umbrella, travel in groups, but basically just avoid the area if you can. Some Australian states have even set up apps where people can now report where there's a nest or a problem magpie so that you can check if there are any swooping magpies on your route. So really the advice is try to avoid them. But if that's just not possible, experts say you can actually make friends with them. So they suggest giving them a little bit of food, like a tiny piece of bread or a little bit of meat, as kind of a peace offering.
I see they're also suggesting that you wear protective gear and even something called a magpie hat. What is that?
Magpie hats are an Australian tradition. Growing up, often your parents will sit you down and you'll have a bit of fun making a magpie hat. They used to be plastic ice cream containers and you'd draw eyes on them or you'd stick some eyes on them. But these days, people are getting really creative. I've seen some ones where people have rigged up party poppers to their hats, and so they blow those when the magpie gets close. And we've even seen some people gluing fake magpies to their hats to ward off any real ones.
Tiffany Turnbull. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
This video, shot in an Indian city after dark, shows a man and a woman being forced from their motorbike by a mob. She's Muslim, he's Hindu.
A special report into harassment of interfaith couples in India. It's 1 year since Russia's illegal annexation of 4 Ukrainian territories, a decision that sparked almost universal condemnation. President Putin defended the move and claimed that Russia had become stronger for it. But Russia is not even in full control of the 4 regions it claims to have annexed: Donetsk, Luhansk, Zaporizhia and Kherson. And more than a year and a half after its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Russia appears no closer to winning the war there. From Moscow, our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg reports.
1 year ago, the Kremlin leader proclaimed the annexation of Ukrainian land, 4 regions of the country under partial Russian occupation.
Благодаря вам. Вашей твердости и решительности.
Today, Vladimir Putin claimed that Russia had become stronger because of it. Together, he said, we can meet any challenge. But only 2 countries have recognized the annexation, Syria and North Korea. Perhaps that's why the anniversary celebrations here have been slightly muted. There was a large-scale, highly choreographed patriotic concert on Red Square, but the president stayed away. Pensioner Yelena went along, though. We have restored part of our historic motherland, Yelena tells me. But these territories are Ukraine, I reply. No, they're Russia. Only Russia, she retorts. Our sons have been fighting to get their land back. That is exactly how the Kremlin wants Russians to feel, that somehow the war in Ukraine is just and right, that Russia is succeeding and expanding.
Steve Rosenberg. It may have a population of just 500,000 people, but its strategic position in the Indian Ocean makes the Maldives strategically important for two superpowers, India and China. That's why the presidential election there matters so much. And on Saturday, it was confirmed that the pro-China opposition candidate has been victorious. He emerged as the surprise frontrunner during the first round of voting in September. I asked our South Asia regional editor, Lipika Pelham, what this might mean.
The current government has actively sought to strengthen ties with India for a very long time. And the opposition force actually pressed the government to weaken such ties or even end India's military presence altogether. So the main issue dominating the India-China debate is actually India's controversial military presence in the Maldives. And Muizu's party amplified an India Out campaign. The opposition party expanded the appeal, the India Out appeal, beyond the capital Male to outer islands. And the opposition addressed India's relationship with the Maldives with a range of emotions. It used nationalistic fervor against India's power, India's control, India's clout, both political and economic, and calling this like crimes of the government that might reduce the Maldives to being a slave to India.
And ethnically, are the people of the Maldives Indian?
The Maldives has been connected to India in cultural, ethnic and economic terms for centuries. Some Maldivians come from southern India, and the origins of the language, Divehi, goes back all the way to Sanskrit and Pali. And Maldivians have long traded with India historically, and they love Hindi music and many study in India.
But now this is going to be a big change then. There's going to be more of a relationship with China. What does that mean?
When they were in power during 2013 to 2018, during those 5 years, they built substantially strong relationship with China and borrowed quite heavily under the Belt and Road Initiative program, infrastructure program. Both Beijing and Delhi, we know, are vying to kind of influence the region. And Beijing is obviously celebrating because the old connection between 2013 and 18 can be renewed now, you know.
Is it likely that the Indian military presence in the Maldives will end?
Well, despite China's influence being re-established in the region, I do not think that India's influence is going to go away. It has been the dominant regional power, and also because until recently, India's neighbourhood first policy was completely applied to Maldivian foreign policy. And this was the main component, as we know, of the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's foreign policy.
Lipika Pelham. Videos from across India showing interfaith couples being harassed and in some cases assaulted by mobs of men are going viral on social media. The attacks appear to have been triggered by claims that Hindu men are trying to seduce Muslim women as part of a sinister conspiracy to lure them away from their communities. The BBC's Shruti Menon has been trying to find out if the claims have any merit.
This video, shot in an Indian city after dark, shows a man and a woman being forced from their motorbike by a mob. She is Muslim, he's Hindu. The mob, which seems to be made up of Muslim men, are heckling her and beating him. The exact circumstances are unclear, but it's one of many others that follow a similar pattern going viral online. The accounts pushing them bear the same phrase, Bhagwa love trap. Bhagwa is being used as shorthand for extreme right-wing Hindu supremacists. Hindus are trying to seduce Muslim women, the theory goes, and lure them away from their communities. Who believes it? Mostly Muslim men. They are behind the social media accounts spreading the rumor. I spoke to one of them who wanted to remain anonymous. This is an actor's voice.
This has been going on for years. Hindu boys befriend Muslim girls and entrap them in love. When they've had enough, the Muslim girls are forced to suffer. It's a conspiracy.
Whatever you make of the theory, that point will resonate with anyone who's been watching Indian politics for the last decade. He pointed me to this video as evidence. This is Yogi Adityanath, a mid-ranking politician speaking 16 years ago. You can hear him shouting, if they take one Hindu girl, we'll take at least 100 Muslim girls. Today, he's risen to become the chief minister for the state of Uttar Pradesh and a senior member of Prime Minister Narendra Modi's party, the BJP. We asked him if he still stood by the statement. He did not reply. I asked a right-wing Hindu leader, Alok Kumar, what he thought of the theory and that clip.
With all that is in my knowledge, there is absolutely no evidence of such a trap being run by Hindus.
Alok Kumar says he hasn't seen the Yogi Adityanath speech, but that, either way, statements like these don't represent the views of most Hindus. He is more concerned about another theory, much older and much better known.
Muslim men being threatened, harassed and beaten. They've been accused of love jihad, seducing Hindu women with the aim of converting them to Islam. It's a conspiracy theory that's everywhere in India.
Love jihad, the idea that Muslim men are trying to seduce Hindu women. Essentially, the reverse of the Bhagwa love trap. It's an idea that has gained a lot of currency in recent years. We've looked through some of the evidence on offer for both theories. Investigations into allegations of love jihad in Uttar Pradesh, carried out by two prominent Indian news outlets, did not provide convincing evidence for the theory. While reliable evidence is scant, or at least inconclusive, one thing seems clear. This is very much a story of India's divisions in 2023. A heady mix of religious tension and gender politics to boot. It's proving fertile ground for theories like these to flourish online and spill over into real-world harm.
The BBC's Shruti Menon reporting, and you can hear the full story on BBC Trending this weekend on the World Service, or listen online, just search for BBC Trending. Imagine a United States in which large parts of the country remain majority Native American. That's what the writer Francis Spufford, author of the award-winning Golden Hill, has done for his latest novel, Cahokia Jazz. Cahokia is a real place outside St. Louis, Missouri, and this is a murder mystery which also takes in music, hence the jazz in the title, and the spread of disease. Michelle Hussein asked him why he decided to set the book in this particular setting.
Because it was extraordinarily a thriving medieval city in North America and is therefore a kind of image for what was lost in the Columbian catastrophe. When the conquistador De Soto went up the Mississippi, he found it densely populated with people, with sort of big towns on both banks. And then all of that had gone, ravaged by European diseases in the next couple of hundred years. And I wanted to ask what it would have been like if there'd been so many Native Americans that the United States had to reckon with them and couldn't push them onto reservations and couldn't push them to the margins of the national story. And in my book, the city of Cahokia still has an ancient core, but it's 1922 and it's surrounded by canneries and factory chimneys and there's jazz echoing in its streets. It's a successful hybrid.
How does disease come into it?
Because the changing point is that it was the less drastic form of smallpox that arrived in the New World first, which confers immunity against reinfection and kills about 1% of its victims rather than 30%. Native American populations, the estimates vary wildly, but from tens of millions on up, crashed, often before they laid eyes on a single white person, just because the germs had got there first. That's the pretext for the book. It's the excuse for writing something that is basically a kind of remix of American history or a sort of jazz improvisation on it. I'd read about medieval Cahokia and I'd never heard of it, and I was astonished by its scale and sophistication and thought, what if it had continued the way that Mexico City has continued, for example? What if instead of being this bare and rather melancholy archaeological site, which I've visited in the depths of winter, what if it was the center of a kind of energetic, optimistic early 20th century American city?
Optimistic is interesting because as we were talking about alternative histories, it made me think about that Man in the High Castle, that book and then TV series where the Nazis win the war and are in power in the States. But you imagine a better society than America in the 1920s where Native Americans had developed a good relationship with white settlers?
Well, I think on tougher terms than that. The great thing about alternative history is it's very good for exploring what the stakes were in big historical changes. So you can do moral disasters like the Nazis winning, but you can also look at ways in which it could have been better, which has the sly effect of making history seem less inevitable. And Cahokia Jazz is an ambiguous and rather gory utopia in which even righteous power turns out to be served by some very unrighteous means, but still a better place than the one we had. And it's supposed to be a sly, ironic reminder that the tragic things in American history and all our history are perhaps not quite as inevitable as all that.
Francis Spufford speaking to Michelle Hussein about his latest book, Cahokia Jazz. And we end on the story of Wally, an alligator rescued from Disney World in Florida 7 years ago, who has turned around the life of his owner, Joe Henney. They go everywhere together, even Major League Baseball games. Joe needs Wally for his support, but the Philadelphia Phillies weren't quite so keen, as the newsroom's Daniel Mann reports.
Think of emotional support animals, and dogs, cats and rabbits inevitably spring to mind. Think of a 1.5-metre alligator and panic sets in. But not if its name is Wally, whose owner is Joe Henney.
He is my emotional support alligator.
I'll get lonely and stuff like that there, and he seems to sense that stuff, and he'll come up and give me a hug. And
I laid on the couch, and I wake up, he'd be laying on my head.
Makes me feel loved.
Joe, speaking to CBS News last year at his home in Pennsylvania, was filmed putting his hand into Wally's mouth, even rubbing its tongue. Wally didn't bite its owner, who doesn't keep the alligator in a cage and takes him everywhere on a leash. So Joe decided to take Wally to the ball game in Philadelphia. A fan of the Philadelphia Phillies, he wanted Wally to lend them his support in their match against the Pittsburgh Pirates. Security refused, though if Joe's emotional support animal had been a cat, a parrot or a pig, they would have still been denied entry, as Citizens Bank Park Stadium only allows service dogs for guests with special needs. Wally is, according to Joe, famous for his hugs. And outside the stadium, one Super Phillies fan, who calls himself the Philly Captain on X, found Wally making a new friend.
Is he hugging you?
Yeah. Wow, you're brave. Brave or insane. I don't know what the proper term is. No, it's insanity. Security won't let the alligator in.
So will the Phillies have a change of heart and let Wally in? He could even be their new mascot. Their current one is the Philly Fanatic, a furry, flightless bird who also happens to be large and green with an extendable tongue.
Daniel Mann reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast at this time tomorrow. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Ethan Connolly Forster, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Rachel Wright. Until next time, goodbye.